This is Chico Matsusaka, and welcome to Mission Artist. Our guest for this episode is Sarasota-based teaching artist and certified mindfulness coach, Stevie Jones. Mr. Stevie, as he is known by his students, is passionately dedicated to bringing artistic experiences to students in the classroom with a focus on historically excluded communities. In addition to teaching, Mr. Stevie hosts monthly art and mindfulness events as a part of Newtown Nation's Farmers Market and the Van Wezel Artworks Anywhere program. So without further ado, welcome Mr. Stevie Jones to the Mission Artist Podcast.
Thank you, Chico, for having me on the podcast.
Thank you for being here.
Yes,
I'm really excited about this.
Yes, I'm a Sarasota-based teaching artist. I also do a lot of community engagement, really focused on the Newtown community and other historically, I guess we can say the historically disenfranchised communities, historically excluded communities. And I do other things as well. You know, I'm a storyteller, I'm a public speaker, I'm a girl dad, cat daddy. We just had very, very awesome cat discussions for our respective felines. I try to be a community collaborator. I try to, you know, be someone who helps facilitate helping our kids, all of our kids, feel welcomed, feel celebrated, and feel safe in not only in education, but in other areas in our community, because that's not always the case for all students. So I'm just glad to be here, glad to share my story, or at least share what I do. So thank you for having me. Thank you again, Chico, for having me.
Well, absolutely. I think it was a WSLR interview that I mentioned to you earlier. Yes. That I had heard, and I had felt like you're ticking all the boxes of Mission Artist, because you are a storyteller and you are literally a storyteller as a former journalist. Mm-hmm. And one of the questions that I'm always asking on the podcast is, how did you get to this place you are now doing what you're doing?
It's a great question. I guess you have to start at the beginning, right? You have to start right at the beginning.
Absolutely.
And so I wouldn't be sitting here talking about how important our kids are, or how important our kids feeling better so that they can learn better, which is what I take on as one of my missions in terms of my teaching artistry. I wouldn't be able to do that unless I was had the background that I have. That background includes, you know, having a mom who was a 16-year-old runaway and her being sex trafficked. You know, that's what they would call it these days, sex trafficked, while she was ran away in Hollywood. I don't know who my dad is. It was one of her customers. She was someone who tried. Unfortunately, she didn't have all of the tools. A lot of things were against her. You know, she had me. She had three more children after me, my half brothers and sisters. And she was in a very abusive relationship. At times she was homeless. At times she took us to shelters. And at times she just couldn't take care of us. So she would send us to foster care. And so a lot of my time was spent either homeless, in foster care, or in shelters. So having that kind of childhood, a childhood where you don't always have every meal through the day, or the only meal you have, fortunately, and I'm very thankful, because I was raised in California during a time in the 70s when they had free, they just started rolling out free lunch, free meals, free breakfast. And I have to thank, you know, the Northern California folks for pushing that and pushing something that today, and actually comes from the Black Panther Party, their free lunch program that was basically endorsed by California when I was growing up in the early to mid 70s. And now today is a program. I know it's statewide. I think it might even be nationwide, but free lunches, free meals. So I was one of those kids that relied on that literally growing up. So not having all the tools, not having all the resources really made a big impact, you know. Also seeing different families, different family dynamics, you know. Again, you know, I was raised without a home, so I know what it's like to spend the night outside. And I was raised in foster care. So between those two dynamics, you meet a range of not only families, but human beings, you know, how people live, how they treat each other. And I know one of the things we talked about when we talked earlier was that realization. It really was a masterclass in human dynamics. That's how I view it now as I'm older. But if you would have asked me then, I would have been, you know, I want to get the hell out of here. Whatever's going on with me, I don't know what's going on. I don't know why I don't have a home. I don't know why my mom's not around. I don't know who my dad is or where he's located at. Not having all of that leaves a lot of whys. And if you don't get the right whys, you're going to end up down a lot of wrong paths. Fortunately, one of the things that really saved me, literally saved me, was a few things. Books, comic books, those became my friends. That led to more reading, led to growing my imagination. It encouraged me to be creative. That was so life-saving that from the age of 7 to 12, I carried with me through every homeless shelter, through every foster home, through every any place we were at, any place we found our at. I always carried with me an orange bag about the size of a super thick Bible. Mm-hmm. And I filled it up with torn and ripped comic book pages. And that was my comic book collection. I carried that. That was my, you could have given me $1 million. I wouldn't have wanted it, except for that orange bag filled with beaten up comics. Comics that I would, comics that I was inherit from people. Sometimes I would ask, folks for, a couple of quarters. That's how much they costed when I was growing up, 50 cents, 25 cents. And instead of buying some candy, I would be the nerd when nerds weren't cool. I would be that guy buying a book, and then asking you, can I have a bite of your candy? And then, I'd read out of this book, show you why it's so awesome, why these superheroes are awesome, and then go and want to create that on my own. And so I was very fortunate to have those friends and then have teachers, not every year, but most years, at encouraging teachers that reinforced creativity, encouraged it, reinforced the talents that weren't appreciated or even that at times looked down on. In terms of my family and the community and some of the people that I was around, that was very, very not only life affirming, but life changing. Right now, you're making me think of Miss Lou. She's my sixth grade teacher, my first middle school teacher. I had just left Los Angeles County foster care. They stuck me on a bus, on a Greyhound bus to Northern California and stay at a different foster with a different foster family. And this was the teacher that I had at this, it was actually Monterey County, somewhere, Monterey County, California. And Miss Lou, a middle school teacher, this amazing teacher, she was one of the first teachers that really encouraged me to continue drawing, continue telling stories, and to continue, that it's okay. She also was the first teacher that gave me any kind of award. I still have it. It's a little plaque with a sticker on it from 1985. And it's something that you probably could get at anywhere. It's just a little plaque with a little, sticker on it. And it, you're student of the month, and I've never forgotten her. I've never forgot her compassion or her passion. She's a young Asian American teacher who you could tell she just fresh out of wherever she, bless her, wherever she was educated at. And it wasn't just me. It was everybody. I mean, everybody felt love. And I think that's been one of the themes that we've talked about. She was able to give hope, able to bring joy in this little classroom in a place called Gonzales, California. And so I spent half the school year there. And then we moved to a different location with that same foster family. I didn't have her again, but never forgot her and always thankful. And as a reminder, I've had other fantastic teachers, Mr. Vargas from another foster home in Fresno County. Mr. Vargas was a Spanish teacher and gave me a hard time, to be honest with you, as a high school Spanish teacher. And he was a stout, dark complexioned man who was one of the smartest individuals that I've ever met. And one of the most personable too, and could handle high school kids like myself that had no effing interest in any of his lessons. It was just used as a place for me to draw and model sneakers in my drawing notebook. And so he recognized that and used that as an opportunity that he could have used to make fun of and could have done what I've seen many teachers do And what I've done on a rare occasion, and I've had to check myself at, which is not giving our students dignity all the time, whether it's in discipline or honoring them, but giving them dignity, giving them their respect. And so I'm internally grateful for Mr. Vargas. The Spanish, it stuck, you know, and not as much as he probably would have wanted, but, you know, I roll my R's pretty good and try my best to really have and give respect to the language. But more than anything, I give due respect to his lessons, his life lesson of reaching for more, trying your best. Like, I know you can say it better, and doing it in a way where I didn't feel belittled, where I didn't feel an outsider, which is an experience that many kids of color, BIPOC kids, whatever your label, African-American, Latino, Asian, whatever, you know, Latinx, you know, all of our friends of color feel at times when they're in predominantly white spaces or predominantly non-Black spaces, which is most of the spaces that are in America, to be honest with you, unless you live in certain communities, very special communities where it's in the DNA of these communities that they welcome, that they celebrate, and that they make sure their students, all students, are felt safe too. So teachers, you know, books, teachers, that ingredient right there is why I'm sitting in front of you. And then later on, I would want to add another teacher, other two teachers. When I was in community college, there was a teacher, Dr. Kayende Solzwazi at Fresno City College, who I believe is still there. Mm-hmm. All due love, all due respect. That was my first African-American history class teacher, and just an incredible, mind-blowing experience as someone who's just out of high school and hearing all of your history, your own history, hearing all of your greatness, the greatness that's in your background. To be hearing that stuff for the first time is almost like being Keanu Reeves and Neo in The Matrix. You're being completely pulled out of what you think reality is, and what's being revealed in front of you is this awesomely rich tradition and history that somehow doesn't make it didn't make it in the history books that I read when I was in school. And so that teacher, Dr. Solzwazi, very impactful in terms of really having that, beginning the journey of having self-love and having joy in who I am, in this Black body, in this anti-Black society of America. And so, you know, having that kind of cold water splashed on you, very impactful for me. And so definitely an ingredient as to why I'm very intentional about who I try to reach and what I'm trying to say and what we're trying to experience. And the last teacher would be S.N. Goenka, who's no longer with us. He taught Vipassana meditation. He passed away, I want to say, about 10 years ago. Never met the man, but I've met his students who teach this non-secular Buddhist practice of meditation, silent meditation, which I had the joy of experiencing about 10 years ago myself, which has had an incredible impact on how I approach not only what I teach, but how I approach life and how I have grown to accept the constant change that this life brings, and that we're constantly experiencing and trying to be present, you know, and really deal with past traumas, dealing with, you know, that experience of growing up, of not having the whys. You pick up a lot of bad habits when you're around not healthy people, you know, and I've been, you know, someone who's displayed a lot of those bad habits as a young man, a younger man. And I still have a few of those bad habits, a very, very few, but I have them. And meditation, mindfulness, spiritual fitness, call it, you know, those are the three things that I usually call it. Doing that really helps me be present with my emotions, how I'm feeling, and try to get to the root. Try, you know, attempt to get to, why am I feeling this way? You know, why am I reacting to this? Really just remind myself to have that mindful breath when I, you know, get maybe news that I might not welcome. You know, when I, you know, might be in a situation that I might not feel most comfortable with, when I hear things that might not resonate with myself. I think it's a good, healthy way to check in, you know, to monitor yourself, to see how you're doing, and to help, to be able to trust yourself. Mindfulness helps you trust yourself, to not just, you know, you, I mean, I know you're, me and you are from the same era, which means, you know, our, the saying still around is like, trust your gut, you know, for the kids that are listening and the people that are listening, there's a, that comes from somewhere. A lot of these sayings come from somewhere and are based on some form of reality. And that is definitely one of them, is trust your gut. And for me, as someone who practices mindfulness, is trust your breath, you know, trust your breath, trust that. That is one of your best friends that you have that you might not even realize. That's one of the best friends that's going to stay with you, one of the few that's going to stay with you all the way through your life. You're born into it with your breath breathing, coming out, screaming with your breath. And if you're lucky enough, you're still breathing when you leave and you stop. You know, and so it's your best friend. It's with you every time, and it's one that we forget. And in what I try to do, my teaching artistry, I try to remind our kids, our teachers, our parents, our neighbors to trust in your breath, trust in that, trust in the pause, trust in the space, and see what comes out of that. See what comes out of that. You know, don't send that email. Take a breath. Don't press send on that text. You know, don't do it. You know, I think this has been kind of the week where we can think of examples that are out there in the media where someone could have taken a breath and not sent a text, not sent a tweet, take a breath. Just is that something that I should do right now? You know, because there's consequences when we aren't mindful. There really are small ones and big ones. And so I try to practice mindfulness so that I can, you know, at least welcome the consequences, you know, and the news, regardless of what it is. So yeah, four teachers. I'm sorry.
Yeah. No, that's okay. You bring up this idea of trusting your breath. And we talked earlier about the action of asking why. And it's almost as if taking that breath allows you to ask why.
Yes.
And how we want to transform that why from something of feeling helpless as to something more creatively constructive, which is why I love hearing about your comic books, because, you know, it is a way to channel that why, and sort of like, if I were a superhero, what could I do in this moment?
Right.
My most wished superpower was to be able to stop time.
Wow. That's a cool superpower.
Neo, and just, you know, pull that bullet out of the air. And just say, you know, I'll let everything else play out, but, you know, let's just pull that bullet out of the air.
Awesome superpower. I like the idea of being invisible. I always like being invisible. The idea of being invisible. You know, I was always in these spaces where I was like the only Black kid or the only child of color, you know, in foster homes and stuff. So when I was reading comic books, it was, oh man, what would it be like just to be invisible, to watch these people that are all watching me, or, you know, that, you know, might not see, you know, might not be. So I was always fascinated with that. So I definitely feel you. Stop in time. That would be awesome. You know, just to kind of like, that's not going to happen. I'm going to take a left instead of a right, you know?
Yeah. There was also something that when you were talking about your teachers, it reminds me of something else that you talked about in another podcast with Valerie Bouchon and Newtown Nation. And that is about teaching not just ourselves, but kids, that they deserve, they just simply deserve. And that
best.
For a lot of people that grew up in a similar childhood as yours, you're not taught to feel like you deserve that.
Yeah.
And I think the gift of these teachers were, you know, they were like, of course you deserve this. You deserve this opportunity, and you deserve to be treated with dignity.
Yes.
So I think that...
Absolutely. Absolutely. You have to give your best to them. Because the world is getting harder. The world's not getting easier. And they know it.
Yeah.
They see everything. Unfortunately, some of them are experiencing trauma worse than anything I could even have gone through. Worse. And so when I approach all of our kids, it's with the idea of meeting them where they're at, but also trying to encourage them that it's going to be okay. It's obviously different approaches for different ages, but at every stage, they have to feel that love. They have to feel that joy. They have to feel that worth. And I think I clue in on that because I know what it's like to feel worthless. I know what it's like to feel like I was one of the kids that looked into houses during the holidays to see people doing what they do, families. And I understand being outside of all of that, outside of the cookie cutter view that this country and that this society wants you to think everybody experiences. And it's okay not to experience that. In fact, for some people, that's not a good thing. That's not their thing. And I've understood that as I've gotten older. Again, that definition has changed. And so to be somebody who's been told you're not going to be shit, literally, by a foster parent, by someone who feels like they're an authority to you, and to understand that that still exists. The only difference is people are doing that stuff. Grownups are doing that stuff on camera. It's just kids are catching them on TikTok and their asses are getting put on TikTok. And it's sad that some of them are teachers. That's what's sad, is that some of these people that are going viral are racist teachers. And so with these, some people call them microaggressions, macroaggressions, with these, what I call traumatic experiences, that whether it's whether you're someone who's African-American, whether you're a woman of color, whether you're a trans or trans kids or LGBTQ kids that are going through, being seen, being recognized, being made to feel safe. We can go through any number of marginalized communities that have children that deserve the very best from us as teachers and teaching artists and people in the education space. And it's our job to not only make sure that they feel welcomed, celebrated, safe, but it's also our job to communicate that out in the community as well. Regardless of whatever community issues they're dealing with, whether it's being disenfranchised economically, whether it's issues of straight up safety, gun safety, whatever that range is, and believe me, it's all in there. Things just aren't happening in the bad part or the bad schools anymore. There's people with automatic weapons just walking into schools. So this isn't just something that, it's just to that community. These are issues that are broader and that come out in different ways in different communities in this country. It's something that we need to be aware of and have a plan for and incorporate it. Some of our students' realities. And so these are things that we need not run away from or not talk about. We need to run to them, lean into them, lean into these very hard, rough conversations and issues with compassion and empathy. Because again, these kids see it. They don't need me or you or anybody to interpret anything for them anymore. All of it's on YouTube and TikTok. These kids, they're learning incredibly, incredibly complex things because of social media. So the role of the teacher is changing. The role in the education sector is changing. And we need to be in front of all that and be responsive to that, again, in an empathetic way, in a compassionate way, in a way that gives them dignity. Doesn't remind them of the stereotypes or systemic racist systems that they deal with and racist messages that we're seeing, not just in the political season, but we're just seeing reinforced in different areas in our society. It's sad. It's kind of sad on a certain level, but it's also something that's an opportunity. And again, I think we talked about that, right? We talked about our three things, right? We have the hope, right? We have our joy, we have our love, and that helps combat, looking at these things in such a negative light to where, you start getting fired up or you start getting depressed. We have to continue to move those dark clouds. There's a sun behind that. There's literally a bright sun constantly shining on us, regardless of where the clouds are, constantly. We see the sea change. We see it. We saw it in this most recent election. There seems to be something in the air. It looks like people are tasting the Kool-Aid and they don't like the taste as much. And so it's things like this that you have to be able to look at and not miss it. That's it right there. That's the hope. That's the hope for the day. Boom. And hold on to that. So that when you get that other kind of news, the other news that's reaffirming that, oh yeah, man, I live in a pretty segregated town, or oh yeah, these resources really aren't earmarked or even, you know, envisioned for a certain type of student in this town. We understand that a large part of this community has accepted that status quo. And there's also an understanding that there's a large group of us that have not accepted that, that we know we can do better. And that we believe we can do better, and that we are doing better, and we can do better together. And that's kind of, I kind of see it more of a half glass full than a glass half empty, you know, and the kids help with that. The kids help bring the joy, bring the love, bring the hope. They bring that. You want to be the most present with them. You know, they're watching everything you do. Every adult that they're around, they're watching, they're understanding, and they're picking up and not just picking up, they're acting out like that. You know, and so we have to encourage them to better understand those influences and how they impact their lives and some of these decisions that they're making.
So to backtrack a little bit, could you tell us a little bit about your experience as a journalist and how that might have also helped you sort of do what you're doing now or to see, give you a different macro view?
Yes. No. That's a great, great question. Yes. That's also very integral. You know, everything's built on the writing. You know, I mean, if it really comes down to it, you know, everything is built on the art. I want to encourage everybody, all of our artists, there's a lot of power in your art. In fact, your art makes you powerful. And I view my art as having my back. And so circling back to the original question about journalism, it feeds directly into the desire of, I can do comics, I can draw stories like this too. Instead of drawing, though, I get to draw with words. I still liked drawing as a child, but somewhere between letting go of comics, I fell in love with the word. And I fell in love with, really, I fell in love with like fantasy, like science fiction and fantasy and horror novels, you know. So the Stephen King phase that I went through, the Robert E. Howard phase that I went through, you know, a lot of these were just straight up werewolves, you know, zombies and fantasy novels, you know, and they just kind of took things to a different level for me. I still appreciate, and even more so now that I'm older, appreciate comic books and that medium, particularly graphic novels. It gave me a greater appreciation for this kind of bigger story, that these littler stories in bigger stories. And that desire, that, you know, that desire as a storyteller of, you know, pushing out and exploring, you know, every artist is, you know, on this journey. For me, let me just kind of make sure that I, you know, qualify this. I am speaking for myself and my journey as an artist. My journey has included a lot of exploration. And I'm assuming that a lot of other artists do that as well. There's a lot of not only exploration, there's a lot of copying. There's a lot of imitating, a lot of doing things, of trying things, pulling things in and seeing what can be used as repeatedly as a tool or what is just an experiment. And so there's a lot of experimenting and you're broadening your knowledge by searching. You know, you're searching for things that have inspired you. And so in that search, well, I'm to say, and in this pushing out and exploring, one of those things was journalism. You know, one way to not only practice your writing, practice the craft, but there's interesting stories in there, different ways to tell stories. And it's kind of based on reality. And so when I began to start thinking about how I wanted to continue writing on a college level, I started taking journalism classes because, you know, English classes, they weren't doing dissertations or, you know, any kind of this kind of what I would consider dry writing. I wanted my stuff to pop. However, for my own definition, whether that's that being rooted in reality, you know, whether it's a crime story and something's happening to somebody, or whether it's a fiction story, whether it's a detective novel or something. So in college, I started taking journalism classes and that led to being part of the student newspaper. I wasn't part of the student newspaper in high school or yearbook or anything. That was something that happened later on when I started realizing I'm going to graduate from college and I want to be a writer and I do not want to be writing novels. I want to do something, or I don't want to be writing grants. I don't want to be writing research. I want to do something else, something with pop. And so after doing a particular story, there was during my second to the last year of school in college, an African-American student at the same college was attacked at a fraternity party by racist gang, a white supremacist gang. That student, I didn't know him, but he lived across the street from my apartment. I lived near campus. He did too. And when that happened, that was an opportunity. The fraternity that he got attacked at just so happened to be located behind his apartment. So he was just a neighbor who heard a party. And some of the people, some of the men and women, some of the students, female and students that were there, invited him there. He wasn't part of the fraternity. He was just a neighbor. And he got savagely beaten with a pipe, with a conduit pipe, and ended up being brain damaged and didn't finish his college career. And really a sad kind of story. It fired up our campus, and it thrust me into, again, an opportunity to, I was taking a college journalism class. I was part of the newspaper at that point, and it happened across the street from my house. So all of those things together gave me my first real journalism experience that intersected with my writing and something that I felt strongly about, which is anti-racism. And so, yeah, it was a learning lesson. That experience, which included the mainstream newspaper trying to criminalize the Black student, which included the KKK coming to our campus and handing out flyers and then following that up with trying to do some kind of event, which brought out the police. Every phase of this, including interviewing the parents who visited him in the hospital, I ran stories about. And that was my baptism in journalism before I even got a real journalism job. And that meant me walking right into said fraternity and interviewing the entire fraternity for a story. So a series of stories came out, and that local newspaper that was trying to criminalize that student, they ended up hiring me, not for that story, but that summer to be an intern, because they read what I was doing, and I had sent in the clips when I applied, and someone in the journalism department said they were hiring interns. And that led to, so I did that, and that internship was throughout my senior year of my last year of college. And then that led to an internship in Northern California newspaper. They hired me. I covered schools, cops, crime, courts. That's where I cut my teeth, you know, and did the range of everything. At the paper's called the Stockton Record, or just the Record. Stockton's located just south of Sacramento in Northern California, east of Oakland. And did that. I won some awards. I got a fellowship, and was flown out here to St. Petersburg for the, they're called something else now. I think they're the Society of Feature Journalists. They had given me a fellowship for a few articles that I wrote, including one about being profiled by the Stockton Police Department, actually being profiled right after I got off of work, off of a late night shift of writing cop stories. So a lot of irony in that, in that experience, but that experience was one of, again, a journalistic career turning point that got the attention of these editors, and they flew me out, and we became part of this week-long awesome experience, being surrounded by really big editors and, you know, from big newspapers. And that led to a job in Sarasota, you know, and I eventually got hired at the Herald Tribune, spent a few years covering entertainment, nighttime entertainment, and music. And then, you know, and throughout all this, you know, you're understanding kind of not only just the things that you enjoy writing about, but you're understanding the other side of the quote unquote business, the corporate side of the business. So I was a journalist before 2008. That marks a pretty important year to a lot of modern day journalists, because that's the year that everything came crashing down. So during that period, there's a record number of layoffs as the industry contracted and shrunk. A lot of folks were let go, fired, a lot of experienced people, a lot of really talented people, knowledgeable people. And watching that, experiencing that, I didn't want to be a part of that. And so I walked away from that, but didn't walk away from the skills that I learned. As a journalist, you learn so many skills. You learn how to track people down. You learn how to push yourself into spaces so that you can ask questions or skate into those spaces, whatever you can push yourself or skate into it, doesn't matter. you get all of these talents, you become someone who has to organize various different aspects of a beat. If you cover a beat, I covered entertainment, I covered different beats, schools, courts, cops. That gives you so many skills, you know, communication skills. You're not only writing, you're talking to people, you're interviewing people. And I was also someone that was early on incorporated technology. I've been incorporating digital storytelling since I came out to Florida back in the early 2000s when people didn't know what a podcast was. But, you know, when you had to actually, instead of software that was in your computer, you had to use hardware to hook up to a phone and do that. Technology's always been part of, and journalism's always been part of the things that I do creatively, just like writing. Writing's the base, you know, imagination, obviously. But a lot of skills picked up during journalism that I use today and that are perfect for today and what I do. Organizing, coordinating, keeping track, following up with people, communication, and really trying to keep everyone in terms of communication, over communicating, making sure everyone's connected as much as we can so everybody can feel part of what's going on, being a part of it.
Going back to the technology part, we talked earlier about where kids are, the kids that you want to reach, and you point out that they are already there in that tech sphere, social media, where they connect and communicate.
That's where they're at. They're there. They're there. And then they're, and they want to teach us. You know, all we have to do is listen. I'm sounding like the old people that were around when I was a kid. This is the new thing. Come teach me. Technology moves forward. The society moves forward. The kids get smarter. You know, we benefit because we, in turn, our communities get smarter. All we have to do is listen to them. They're going to tell us and share their stories if they trust us. And they're only going to trust us if we're present. They're only going to trust us if we listen, make them feel welcomed, and we make them and we celebrate them. Even the things that make us uncomfortable. We're talking about letting them move the way they want to move, letting them interact the way they want to interact. And most importantly, letting them share the stories they want to share. We have to help them see themselves. Social media does that. It's like any other form of newness, new technology, new thing that we can use to get to our students. And it's incumbent that we do that because they're listening to that more than they're listening to their teacher. And they're listening, some of them are listening to that more than they listen to their parents. So it's incumbent on that we welcome that. And I'm here to welcome that. I want everybody to know. I want our kids most especially to know that there's a TikTok teacher here, that there's a TikTok teacher here in Florida, in Sarasota, Florida, that wants you to use TikTok, YouTube, Instagram, anything to tell your story, to give your book review, to do your history assignment, to talk about your math problem. I want you to know that there's someone here that welcomes the way you want to communicate and express yourself. That's me. And I'm not alone. There's a whole bunch of us out here. So you go ahead and ask your teachers. You go ahead and ask your community center leaders. Ask them. Let's get some TikTok people in here. Let's get some folks that want to teach us and explore with us. These things aren't that new. They're based on literacy. They're based on reflection. They're based on storytelling. These ideas that these kids are doing, those ideas that you're seeing on TikTok, those are stories. As short as they are, whether it's a prank or anything, that's a story in there. They're thinking about stories. They're thinking about character. They're thinking about action. They're thinking about the drama. And they're able to capture, if you got to do anything about these kids, you got to give it up to them that they're able to be awesome camera people. They're capturing like the goofs of all of us. Like they're capturing goofs at the perfect time. These kids are experts. They're master blooper catchers. We have to learn how to use this stuff to reach our kids. The next thing that comes out, the next president, the next leader is going to be familiar with TikTok. The next people that are coming up that are raised in TikTok and YouTube, they will have kids that will be moving that technology on. And it's our job in the grand scheme of things is to open our arms to them. That's our job, to open our arms up to all of them and hug all of them, even if they don't want to hug, even if they're telling us they don't, we have to. Because some of them are feeling how I felt when I was a kid, not loved, not seen, not respected. In fact, the complete opposite, not welcomed. What are you doing here? Let me look at you the whole time. Let me intimidate you. since you're in this space, let me disrespect you. Let me treat you like dirt and talk to you as such. Our kids go through that. And as you can tell by my passion, that's something that I feel very, very strongly about. No child should have to experience racism, but some of our kids are experiencing that every day and at a place where they shouldn't be feeling that at all. Sometimes that's at school, in their classrooms. That's not safe. And that's because folks aren't looking at our children, all children, with that same dignity and welcoming them, celebrating them. Yes, when I say celebrate, yes, it's a party, bro. It's a party. They come in the room, it's a party. Because we don't know what they've gone through in the last two, since we last saw them, when they left home. We don't know what they're going through, what they've experienced. And for me, schools were the safest place. That's where the best adults were at when I was growing up. The best ones were at school. They were the smartest, the most compassionate, fed you, took care of you, and they still do that. And that's what makes them so amazing. And so we have to continue to make sure that our teachers, the ones that do see our kids, the ones that do honor our children, all children, that we support them, that we do the things in the community that reinforce what they're doing in the classroom. I'm talking about the ones that are not burned out, the ones with hope, with love and joy. So I'm sorry I got on my soapbox for a little while. I feel strongly about this because this happens so often in our classrooms and nobody talks about it. They want to overlook it. And it's hard on everybody. This isn't about a rant about teachers or about parents or about kids or about schools. It's about digging in and examining why people do what they do to our kids. And if you're a school or an organization that deals with children and you're not doing that, you're going to continue to have the problems you have. Every child deserves the dignity, the respect, the celebration on their journey. It is literally all about the kids. And so, you know, we continue to try to find ways, positive ways, to give quality education experiences, incorporating what the kids are into, while also maintaining that high level of education standard. And all of that's possible. It's not a dream. I know some of you guys are out there that might listen to this and think, that's not possible. It is. We just have to believe and work together. Can't do it alone. Can't do it in separate camps. We have to be okay with our differences and understanding our differences and understanding that certain people's privileges stop when it comes to being disrespectful, not understanding your own history, or trying to shortchange anybody in this educational ecosystem.
Thank you for joining us on Mission Artists. If you'd like to learn more about our guests and our mission, you can log on to missionartists.org or hear us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and Podbean.